Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Si se puede. Yes, we can. Those chants coming from Porterfield State Park in California yesterday as hundreds of Central American migrants hit a literal wall and a metaphoric one, too. Asylum seekers, the caravan President Trump has railed against, told they have to wait. The U.S. is full. Customs and Border Protection saying it's reached capacity. Those migrants are now in limbo, and the Trump administration says fraudulent asylum claims will be prosecuted. This hour on Point, the right to asylum in the U.S. You could join us on air or online. What do you make of the caravan? And of their being halted at the border. Should these people be granted asylum or turned away? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll discuss the opening of a new museum and memorial to lynching victims. That's in Alabama. But first, asylum and the southern border. Joining me now from San Diego is Jean Guerrero. She's Frontreras reporter for KPBS and covers immigration and the U.S.-Mexico border. She was in Tijuana yesterday with a caravan. Jean Guerrero, welcome to On Point.
Hey, David. Great to be here.
So set the scene for us. What would you have witnessed? What would we have witnessed had we been there with you in Tijuana yesterday?
So when the group finally marched to the San Ysidro port of entry in the afternoon, right before they marched, they received word about the fact that Customs and Border Protection had reached capacity at the San Diego ports of entry. The group was kind of unsure what that meant for them, given the fact that the Department of Homeland Security had said earlier, a few days earlier, that they were going to be sending additional resources to deal with the caravan. The caravan was sort of surprised that the ports had reached capacity before they even started marching to the ports of entry. Mm-hmm. But they decided to march anyway. And when they got there, it was a very interesting scene because there was Mexican federal police, the Mexican army, Mexican immigration officials, and they basically stopped the group, more than 200 asylum seekers associated with the caravan, in their tracks and said, you can't enter the U.S. Only a small group can go in and see if CBP has changed their mind. And so about 50 people went through the gates, but they were told by Customs and Border Protection that, in fact, the ports had reached capacity and they would have to wait until there was more space and resources to process people. So they decided to camp outside until that happened. But as far as I know, not a single person has yet been processed.
Before we get to the question of law, just sketch for those of our listeners who aren't aware of the tale of this particular caravan. You know, where were these people coming from, and why would they come in a group together?
Right. So most of the asylum seekers were coming from Honduras, where a very divisive presidential election late last year has led to killings in the streets. People telling me that they saw their neighbors and friends being gunned down, and after protests against the results of the election. So many people decided to flee with their children. Most of the people in this caravan are families who wanted to come to the United States and ask for asylum specifically because of the conditions in their home countries. They felt they had, some of them received actual death threats, some just feared for their lives. But these caravans they join these caravans partly because there's safety in numbers. Central Americans are often targeted by cartels in Mexico because they're such vulnerable groups while they're traveling. But also because these caravans, which have been going on for about a decade, are supposed to raise awareness about the violence in Central America and the general plight of asylum seekers. Mm-hmm. So joining this caravan, there were multiple reasons for being in it.
We've got a call from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Chris, go ahead.
My question is this: why do liberals, and I'm using that word in quotes, it seems like it's the default position of liberals that anybody who isn't born in the United States has a God-given or it's natural law or some sort of right to come to this country. It's like it's written in the, you know, somewhere in the United States code, U.S. code, something, something. Uh-huh. It's in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. It's not. And while I am not anti-immigration, I understand 97, 98, whatever percentage of us are immigrants to this country, and it's
sure
what makes this country great. But, you know, somebody it shouldn't be the default position that if somebody shows up the border and says, hey, I want in, they're allowed in. They need to prove whatever.
Sure.
And if they're bad people, and if it's like in Central America, there's bad people down there, my personal opinion is our resources would be better spent going down there, wherever there is, you know, El Salvador, for example, and cleaning up the house.
Well Chris, let's get in. I appreciate this. Let's get an answer to your question, though, that I think is the heart of what you're raising, which is about the question of U.S. law and what the rights are for asylum. Gene Guerrero of KPBS, you covered this. What does the law say briefly about the right people have to apply for asylum as they hit our borders?
So people who one thing that's important to clarify is that if a person comes to the border, whether it's a port of entry or somewhere in between, and says that they fear returning to their home country or that they want asylum, it doesn't guarantee that they're going to get asylum. It doesn't guarantee that they're going to be let loose into the United States. What the law says is that U.S. Customs and Border Protection or Border Patrol, basically any of the officials who patrol our border, need to take these people into custody if they express a fear or of returning to their home country or a desire to apply for asylum. And then they have a right to speak with an asylum officer who will determine if they have what's called credible fear of returning to their home country for one of several reasons, for example, being persecuted on the basis of their ethnicity or their religion. And they need to provide some kind of proof. I mean, they essentially need to convince this asylum officer that they have this credible
and
fear.
Only then do they then get sort of the full hearing, right? And get the full,
exactly.
Once there's
and,
that.
And they could spend months, even years in detention before they're able to see an immigration judge. Most of these people are kept in detention.
Right, to get that hashed out. And they are held for quite some time. Let's hear, what President Trump had to say. He spoke at a campaign-style rally in Washington, Michigan, if I'm not mistaken. And he addressed the question of this caravan of migrants slamming the country's current immigration system.
Our laws are so corrupt and so stupid. I call them the dumbest immigration laws anywhere on earth. If a person puts their foot over the line, we have to take them into our country. We have to register them. We then have to ask them a couple of questions. Lawyers are telling them what to say, how unsafe they are. And once they say that, we have to let them go to come back to court in like a year. Only one problem. They don't come back. Okay, that's the end. Welcome to the United States.
During that speech, President Trump also said he may support a government shutdown in September if Congress doesn't meet his funding demands for border security. Let's hear directly from the Trump administration about what's happening now at the U.S.-Mexico border and policy. Joining me now from Washington is Hogan Gidley. He's Deputy White House Press Secretary. Hogan Gidley, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, David. Thanks for the time.
Hogan, as we've heard, under federal law, people seeking asylum have a right for an initial hearing. Why is there at the moment no room at the inn down there?
Well, I mean, the problem exists because loopholes and, quite frankly, a lax Congress have allowed this to occur for decades now. We find ourselves in a situation where people are trying to get to this country, and you had a lot of people there on before me talking about the credible fear claim. One of the biggest loopholes in our immigration law is, in fact, credible fear, because the burden of proof is so light, is so small on what they actually have to prove mm-hmm. to get into the country. And to give you some statistical data, before 2013, about 1% of arriving aliens claimed the credible fear asylum. Now it's up 1,700% to 2016. It is overused incorrectly used so much. And when those statistics come in and you see a 1,700% increase in the credible fear claim, one can only discern one result, and that is people know our immigration laws are lax. They know these loopholes. Otherwise, they wouldn't be claiming credible fear. They come here because they know they can get in, and there's little if no recourse to keep them out.
And I want to get to that a little bit more after the break. I do want to ask you, though, this, I mean, the question of a hearing is a right under federal law. So why are we not able to accommodate that, or at least take the steps to accommodate that now?
Well, look, there is a hearing, but that's the point of the loophole, because once you, under like a catch and release system, for example, you have you set the hearing, you set the date, the problem, but you have to release the immigrant into the American population with little or no documentation whatsoever, with a promise that the person's going to come back to court at a later time to have the hearing. Well, that almost never occurs. So what you've done is literally allow people into this country with zero vetting whatsoever, zero record whatsoever, and then they're out in the population. It look no further. A report in Newsweek, and quite frankly, all over the news, there was someone arrested in this caravan who was a member of the MS-13 gang, who, as you know, is one of the most horrific gangs in the world, trying to pose as someone seeking asylum coming through with this group, because they know those things happen. So drug kingpins, gang kingpins, they want to use our lax immigration system.
So
they want to use catch and release to get people here.
And forgive me, just because we're coming up on a break, it sounds as though in some ways you feel the looseness and the laxness that you perceive in sight is driving the inability to perform what is a federally mandated function under law. But we're going to come back to this. We're discussing the caravan of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border, the right to asylum. You can join the conversation. Should these hundreds of Central American migrants be allowed into the country as they seek asylum, or should they have to wait it out in Mexico or be turned away altogether? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers, host of NPR's Embedded, and we've got a new episode all about how Scott Pruitt ended up running the EPA. It's a story about Pruitt's life in the Southern Baptist Church, how he handled a major pollution case, and why he sued the EPA 14 times. Just search for Embedded on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the caravan of migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. They were halted at the border in Tijuana, Mexico yesterday. You can join the conversation. Do we have the dumbest immigration laws anywhere on earth, as President Trump said Saturday? What's the fix? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We have with us on the line from San Diego, Jean Guerrero. She's Fronteras reporter for KPBS. But first, I want to return to our conversation with Deputy White House Press Secretary Hogan Gidley. Thanks again, Hogan.
Hey, David. Sure.
President Trump said that fraudulent requests for asylum would be prosecuted. What did the president mean by that?
Well, we have a sovereign right as a nation, obviously, to protect our borders and to protect the citizenry of this country. Look, people are talking about protecting those trying to get into this country, whether they're claiming credible fear or other loopholes they use to get in this country, like catch and release. But, this president's concentrating solely on protecting our people first. And that includes, by the way, those who have been let into this country as permanent citizens under the most generous immigration laws in the world. I mean, we take in 1.1 million immigrants permanently with green cards every year, 500,000 student visas, hundreds of thousands of guest worker visas. So we have a lot of people in this country every year because we do believe our strength is in diversity. There's no question about that. But it's when people use loopholes and try to abuse our generosity.
Sure.
For either nefarious reasons or not.
But
many people wait in line because they understand it's the greatest country on the planet, and they want to do it the right way. And so when people come here in a way that quite frankly is just against our laws, then that should be met with our legal system and justice.
Just want to briefly drill down on that. Obviously, if people submit asylum, they go for a hearing, they get an administrative thing with a judge, and it's found to be fraudulent, presumably they're tossed out of the country. They're sent back. If they are found after having been given asylum to have lied in federal court, presumably they can be tossed out. What's the prosecution that we want? Are you saying the president wants to prosecute and incarcerate people here and then send them back? Why wouldn't the remedy being just get rid of people who aren't here legitimately?
That's a great question, and the thing is, it's not necessarily, Mexico itself has laws very similar to what you're describing, where they don't have to go in courts, they don't have to wait for time. As soon as they catch somebody coming in, you're out of the country, and that's not necessarily what we're pushing for here. DHS obviously has control of this issue. They're the ones who help prosecute. They're the ones who help develop our laws, but what you're saying is correct, in that if you're found to in your trial to be lying, not telling the truth as to why you're here or why you want to come here, then you're obviously kicked out of the country, and that's as it should be.
Hogan Gidley, I know that we only have a few more minutes before you return to work there at the White House, but I still want to ask, why is this such a big deal for the president and your administration? I looked at the numbers the White House put out earlier this month. I believe it was something like 12,000 people since the beginning of fiscal year 2018, which, of course, began last October, so you're talking about the first half of the year. I'm no math major, and I had the grades to prove it, but I got to say, that added up to a whole lot less than a percentage point of a percentage point. Why are we so exercised about this issue?
Well, the real question is, why aren't the Democrats exercised about this issue? Because for decades, this has gone unchecked. And Democrats used to be for a wall. They used to be for border control. There were several comments about being for the American worker from the Senate floor, from the House floor, from people like Pelosi, from people like Bernie Sanders. Those are the ones who came out in defense of American workers. Those are the ones who came out in defense of having strong borders. Bill Clinton worked on a border wall. So did Hillary Clinton, for that matter. And those are the types of things that have been going on for a long time on the Democratic Party, and they've just turned their back on it for whatever reason. It's very odd. We're exercised about it because we don't want to depress wages. We want to protect the American people, the American worker first, and people who come here illegally hurt our people. That's just a fact.
Respectfully, Hogan, just let me push back a little bit. I mean, I'm old enough to remember, I think it was 1986, Ronald Reagan signed into law a major bipartisan immigration reform. The laws and policies currently in place have evolved certainly under President Obama with leaders like Nancy Pelosi, but also the administration of George W. Bush and congressional Republicans. This seems to me as though it's evolved from a bipartisan tradition. Why do you guys peg this to the Democrats per se?
Well, no. Excuse me, I didn't mean to say that wholly and solely. I'm just pointing out the fact that they used to be on our side on this issue, and when the bipartisanship, as you just pointed out, was completely gone when this president came forward and said, I want to end chain migration. I want to end the visa lottery. But here's another thing. I'm actually going to give three times the amount that Barack Obama offered you guys. I'm going to give them a potential pathway to citizenship, and Democrats wouldn't even come to the table. They wouldn't even have the discussion, which shows they're playing politics with people's lives and, quite frankly, putting the importance, if you will, on hundreds of thousands of people here illegally and unlawfully, as opposed to hundreds of millions of American citizens. That's where the line's been drawn. It's gotten overtly partisan in the last few years. You absolutely pointed to Reagan, no question. But that's the problem with Republicans over the past. The amnesty always comes. It's the enforcement that never shows up. And this president said, look, I ran on that. We're building a wall. We're going to enforce our laws, and we're going to protect our people, whether that's the worker, economically, we're going to protect them, or physically, when you have MS-13 gang members pouring across the border or drug dealers pouring across the border, bringing opioids to this country. As you know, that's one of the president's biggest issues. So there's plenty of blame to go around in Washington, D.C. over our lax immigration system, both Republicans and Democrats. And that's the point of the DACA situation, not to stray too far from the caravan. But this is a congressional fix. It has to come from Congress because that's the way the laws are structured, as you well know.
Yep.
So the president can't unilaterally do these things. He's got to have a Congress willing to get, roll up the sleeves. It always just seems like whenever anything's tough or difficult, Congress is silent.
I got to say, Hogan, that sounds like and that's another emphasis of, I guess, bipartisan unity. The Congress not expecting to get too much done in coming months. We've just been hearing from Hogan Gidley. He's Deputy White House Press Secretary. Hogan, we appreciate so much your time today.
Thank you so much, David.
Thank you, sir. I want to take a call now. David is calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. He has a slightly different look at this. David, go ahead.
Hi, David. Listening to Hogan, it would be laughable if I'm so pathetic because he talks about what Trump says. What Trump and this administration have done is vilified immigrants as rapists, murderers, MS-13 gang members.
Uh-huh.
I grew up in Haiti for 16 years under Papadoc Duvalier, under that dictatorship. And I witnessed, as a child, as a 7, 8, 9-year-old, I witnessed people shot for a militia would cut in line to buy a soccer ticket. Somebody complained, he would walk over and shoot him in the head. And, you know, if families opposed Papadoc, they were just randomly and indiscriminately killed. So this idea that there's not real fear that people are fleeing is absurd. I mean, Americans can't wrap their heads around the horror that people live under. And our country was founded on people that fled oppression. So, you know, this
sure.
is just such an absurd idea.
Well, David, I appreciate that very much. That's an extremely extremely helpful. We're now joined by Alex Mensing from Tijuana, Mexico, project coordinator with Pueblos Sin Fronteras, the main immigration rights group that organized the caravan of Central American migrants that has headed and reached the U.S.-Mexico border. Alex, so much for joining us.
Yeah. Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Can you describe a little bit? I want to drill down a little further. We've heard a lot of characterizations of the folks who are involved there. Tell me what you saw when you witnessed the people of this caravan and who's among them. What are they like?
Sure. So I went down to Tapachula, which is on the Guatemala-U.S. border, Guatemala-Mexico border for a week prior to the caravan leaving, and met the women and children, the whole families. There's a family of 18 people, and that's when we realized that most people were fleeing Honduras. And as Gene mentioned earlier, there was an electoral coup there last year, and unfortunately the U.S. government has been supporting the Honduran government, even as its own military is killing and incarcerating people for protesting. So the people who are on the caravan are Central Americans who fled violence and persecution, and we've had several sessions of legal orientation and assessment by volunteer attorneys who have determined that there are many, many people who do have definitely fear of the kinds of things that may qualify somebody for asylum. And so that's why we've organized these in the past. And they're people who just want a chance to fight an asylum case. Nobody's asking to be granted citizenship right at the border. And these are people who are very clear about why they left. Most of them didn't want to come to the United States.
Take just 20 seconds and explain to me, what does the caravan consist of? Like, if you're watching it go, is it, you know, are these covered wagons? Are they on Greyhound buses? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, that's a good question. So this is a group of people that the lifeline for Central Americans, although it's hard for some people to believe, has been this freight train, this cargo train that travels through Mexico, precisely because on the typical highway routes, they get assaulted, extorted, kidnapped. And so it's a group of people who self-organize. They create their own security commission, food commission, first aid commission, and they begin walking. They can get on the train. Sometimes locals help out with transportation, and sometimes they're able to secure buses to advance.
I want to bring back Gene Guerrero in a moment, but first I want to play a clip of something that President Trump had to say during a tax policy discussion in West Virginia. It was earlier this month. He returned to some of the rhetoric he'd used during his presidential campaign where he called Mexican immigrants rapists. This time he was specifically referring to the caravan, and I want to play what he had to say.
Everybody said, oh, he was so tough, and I used the word rape. And yesterday it came out where this journey coming up, women are raped at levels that nobody's ever seen before.
We should add, NPR has not substantiated that claim. Alex Mensing of Pueblos Sin Fronteras, what do you think when you hear that? What truth or not do you find in those statements?
You know, we had a journalist actually who was on the caravan in Puebla ask one of the women on the caravan if that was true or not, and she just laughed and said, no, this is the reason that I'm on the caravan is specifically so that I not be sexually assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the people who travel through Mexico, the women are sexually assaulted, but not on the caravan. That's simply not true, and I think it actually reminds me of kind of the way Hogan has been characterizing people.
Hogan Gidley, the White House spokesman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by characterizing basically all people from Central America as criminals, which is frankly not true, just like our visitor said, the call-in said.
You know, speaking of Hogan Gidley and the White House, Gene Guerrero, when you listen to what he had to say today, what do you make of that?
One of the things that came to mind when he was talking about people being released immediately, how the United States is forced to release asylum seekers, and then they don't show up for their court hearing. It's my understanding, and in the reporting that I've done, most people are actually kept in detention, especially under the Trump administration. There are cases where women and children are released on parole if they are deemed not to be a flight risk. But they will often have ankle monitors and they have to check in periodically with immigration officials. So this idea that people who come into the United States and ask for asylum will just kind of run away into the United States is false.
And this is, I think, the heart of the claim. It's characterized, and Trump administration was not the first to do so, but characterized as catch and release, right? That the idea exactly. That somehow you get released back into the interior of the U.S. as though you're going to swim upstream and never be heard from again. You're saying people who are often detained for quite some time, but those deemed not a threat are not detained. Do they end up coming through the system, or is there some truth to the administration's claims that those people, you know, vanish from public view and suddenly, you know, live lives here unmonitored and, you know, without an evaluation of how legitimate it is for them to be here or what threat they pose?
I mean, I don't have exact figures, but it's my understanding that a lot of these people do show up for their regular appointments with immigration officials because they have the people who are deemed not to be flight risks often have roots. They end up having jobs, homes, and so they have to show up to their meetings with immigration officials because if they don't, the immigration officials know where they live. They can show up and deport them. They have children, so they don't want to – children in school, for example, and they don't want to just get up and move to escape. So, I'm sure there are many cases where people take advantage and don't show up. But I don't think that this is the most common scenario.
Gene Guerrero, I'm sorry, go ahead, Alex. It's Alex Mensing of Pueblo Sin Fronteras.
Yeah, I'd like to point out a contradiction in the administration's perspective on this because they say that there's attorneys coaching them and telling them what to say, which, first of all, is not true. They're telling people exactly how the system works and encouraging them to tell the truth. But also, the rate of the more people are represented, the more they show up to court. And the fact that the administration has tried to cut legal orientation programs and detention centers and at the same time is upset that some people don't show up to court is a complete contradiction. And the idea that people can just get out, there's in several ICE jurisdictions where people are detained because everyone is detained, especially single adults, at least for some period of time and many for over a year, are denying over 90% of parole requests for arriving aliens who show up at a port of entry. So these are people who are doing this the right way, supposedly, the way the government says it. But then the government, the U.S. government, punishes people for doing it the right way. Not only do they not release them, they're not eligible for a bond from an immigration judge, but also the Customs and Border Protection has been turning people away who show up to request asylum. There was a woman who I worked with a couple of years ago who was turned away four times, even though she showed up with written declarations about what had happened by Customs and Border Protection agents. And so it's completely hypocritical to criticize people who cross illegally, which we never encourage, but you can't punish people for following the law and then expect them to continue to do it when they're fleeing violence and persecution. That's very important. And with regards to the idea that there's MS-13 members coming, if that person was on the caravan, they certainly left it very early on because that report came out when the caravan was still in southern Mexico. And not only that, but if Hogan had actually been had either read the article or had been honest about it, that person was fleeing the gang because he was trying to escape it. A lot of people are recruited into the gang at a very young age, and when they try to get out of it, they're threatened with death, and that actually can be grounds for asylum.
And we'll have to leave it right there. That's Alex Mensing, a project coordinator with Pueblo Sin Fronteras. So glad to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
And we had Gene Guerrero. She's Fronteras reporter for KPBS on the immigration desk. She's been covering this story at the U.S.-Mexico border. So glad to have you with us as well.
Thanks. Great to be here.
It's a story with personal effect. It's a story about rule of law, a story with the question of legalities lingering. After the break, we'll turn to Alabama, where a new museum and memorial just opened to examine a dark chapter in our nation's history, the lynching of thousands of African Americans in the decades after the Civil War. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. Last Thursday, a memorial opened in Montgomery, Alabama, to honor the thousands of African Americans lynched in this country between 1877 and 1950. A few blocks away, on the site of a former slave pen, sits a museum detailing the history of the African slave trade through the modern-day mass incarceration of black men. This may be a tough segment to listen to, and it should be. It represents the legacy of one of the most shameful and violent episodes in U.S. history. You can join the conversation. Have you been to the memorial and museum? How well does this approach reconcile modern-day America to a hateful part of its history? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'd like to play a clip now of Brian Stevenson. He's the founder and director of the Equal Justice Initiative, the group behind the memorial and museum. Speaking to NPR's Debbie Elliott last week, he described the connection between the past and the present.
There's a lot of conflict. There's a lot of tension. We're dealing with police violence. We're dealing with these huge disparities in our criminal justice system. If everything was wonderful, you could ask the question, well, why would you talk about that difficult past? But everything is not wonderful.
Everything is not wonderful. We'll read a couple of examples of people who were lynched during this period. Let's start with Elizabeth Lawrence. She was lynched on July 5th, 1933 in Birmingham, Alabama, a school teacher not accused of any crime but who scolded white children who were throwing rocks at her. An angry mob went to her home, seized her, burned her house to the ground before lynching her. Her son sought justice, and the same lynch mob pursued him, forcing him to flee to Boston. Joining me now from Montgomery, Alabama, is Bro Krift. He's the executive editor of the Montgomery Advertiser. His paper has been telling the stories of lynching victims, and you can find a link to the editorial headlined, Our Shame, the Sins of Our Past, Laid Bare for All to See, at On Point's website, onpointradio.org. Bro Krift, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. It's great to be with you. Thank you.
And with us from Detroit, Michigan, is Kadada Williams. She's a professor of history at Wayne State University. She's the author of They Left Great Marks on Me, African-American Testimonies of Racial Violence from Emancipation to World War I. Kadada Williams, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Professor, I wonder, as a scholar, as somebody who's researched this, as a teacher, as an African-American, what you hear and how you feel when you hear aloud the tale just in miniature of Elizabeth Lawrence?
Well, as a scholar, it rings true to what we know was the case for most lynchings. You know, lynchers, they crafted this narrative of what they said happened, justifying their actions. But many more people were killed for some of the same reasons or for the exact same reason as Elizabeth Lawrence. I have to say that I'm delighted by the museum's opening. I think that their efforts to name the names of lynching victims, to tell their stories from their point of view and not from the lynchers' point of view, mm-hmm. I think represents an incredible opportunity for the nation to possibly move forward.
Kadada, tell me a little bit more about what you mean by that, because I think it's a really important point. This is a museum looking at victims as people with families, effects and repercussions. You've written about that, about how I think in one of your writings you wrote about how somebody testifying before either a congressional inquiry or something talked about, look, these ramifications are current. They didn't just occur in isolation on the night when somebody tried to lynch members of our family.
Right. I think that part of what happens is that a lot of times historians in particular, we access lynching through newspapers. And newspapers tell a story that is often very sympathetic to the killers. Hmm. Or if they're not necessarily sympathetic, then they don't get to the level of victims. They're not directly contacting or shining a light on families' homes. And so it is only when you have African Americans in a position of safety where they can tell their stories, where they can communicate the horrors that the experience horrors that their families and their communities endured, that we can get to the real heart of this violence. And I think that that's, again, part of what we've been missing, this missing piece in the history that the museum's opening is opening the possibility for us to gain access to these kinds of stories, because they go beyond the newspaper headline. They connect with family members. They can sort of reveal their lives beyond that moment, that horrific moment of their deaths.
It's a perfect pivot to Bro Crift, the executive editor of Montgomery Advertiser, obviously a major institution in town as well as the major news outlet in town. Tell me about what it's like to walk through the museum, the memorial, and what it means to your city and your community.
It's a powerful experience to see the narrative unfold from slavery to the modern day.
What do you see?
You see victims of lynching. You see the words that were used to describe people. You see advertisements. You hear the voices of people and their experience, and particularly African-American experiences, which is important. Because like Dr. Williams said, too often African-Americans were characterized in our newspaper and other places almost as stock characters. They weren't developed into full humans. Their experience wasn't described in our paper, for example, throughout the late 19th century and into the early 20th century. We didn't make efforts to make their voices come out. And what you hear in the museum and what you feel in the memorial is quite the opposite of that. It takes responsibility to those voices and make sure they get heard and the names get recognized.
How much of an inspiration was that to you? You wrote fairly remarkable editorial, and your paper has done some really notable pieces of late, reckoning not only with the history of lynching in the American South, in Alabama, in Montgomery, but with your own paper's legacy.
We felt a huge responsibility to take ownership for our past because, unlike you and I, the newspaper existed since 1829. We were a part of this. We were complicit to it. Mm-hmm. And we feel a responsibility as reporters and as editors. We want to be able to show life and show how it means to live, right, to love, to struggle, the regrets. And we didn't do that with the victims of lynchings. We created a narrative wholly rooted in the white perpetrators. For example, there was one man who was killed in Elmore County named Robin White. And we were able to discover documents through our research of our paper. He was lynched. A man actually confessed, and there was a conviction. However, the governor gave clemency to him and two other lynchers. And we had to tell the story through documents that showed the voices of the white men who perpetrated it. In fact, the only known word that came out of Robin White's mouth was goodbye before he was lynched. And I think that's a shame. It's actually a disgrace. It's a false, biased narrative. We weren't doing our job at the time.
A library memorial spreading the idea of accountability and of holding oneself accountable there at the newspaper. I'd like to take a call now from Salem, Virginia. Destin, go ahead.
Hi, David. Yes. So I really have a comment about, I guess, the new memorial in the museum.
Yes,
I think it's really important that we continue to have these talks and these conversations, because even if someone is 27 years old from Southern Virginia and in an area that experienced some lynchings throughout history, it was maybe only a paragraph in public schools. I didn't learn most of this stuff until I got to college, shamefully. Even as a black male that's 27, I should know these things, but unfortunately it isn't covered too well.
Well,
I think it's really good that we're having this conversation and it's coming up.
Well, Destin, I thank you so much for that call. I wanted to offer another vignette at this moment, not a happy one, about a man named Henry Smith, lynched February 1st, 1893 in Lamar County, Texas. He was accused of murdering a white girl. No investigation or trial. A posse seized him. Police did not intervene. He was stripped naked, beaten, placed on a carnival float, paraded through town to the fairgrounds. He was tortured by a mob for over an hour, and that mob burned him alive. His body parts, ashes, and pieces of bone sold as souvenirs.
Kidada Williams, this is heavy history to go through, but yet important history to go to. What was the point? What was the origin? What was the meaning behind these lynchings? What was the message being conveyed? And why was this punishment exacted so horrifically over so many years?
Well, this violence is designed to uphold white supremacy. You know, it occurs during this period after slavery where white supremacists have lost slavery, but they've spent a lot of time trying to hold on to it as much as they can. And so they're looking for new ways to subjugate African Americans, and they do it through Jim Crow segregation. They do it through disfranchisement, and they also have to do it through violence. And they have to do it through violence because African Americans are always fighting and resisting the argument that they're not entitled to any of the nation's privileges, the nation's the sort of fruits of the nation. So they're always fighting and resisting this. And violence, especially public spectacle violence like we see with lynching, becomes an effective way of forcing African Americans to sometimes decide between resistance and survival. What they learn through these killings is that if they resist white supremacy, not even if they accuse, not even if they commit a real crime, but if they resist this sort of new order or this order that they're trying to erect in the Jim Crow era, that this is what can happen to him, happen to them. What happened to Henry Smith, what happened to Elizabeth Lawrence can happen to them too. And so it creates terror within the communities. You have a combination of the death and the fear of being killed or having a loved one killed in this exact same way. And that's what white supremacists wanted. That's what they needed in order to maintain the racial hierarchy that they're trying to create. And it's actually quite effective. And that's one of the reasons why they're able to hold on to it for so long. Lynching doesn't go punished because there are so many people in the community who are benefiting from it at all levels of white society and even at all levels of government, from the local authorities to the federal government.
There was a black man named Elmore Bowling. He was shot to death in 1947 by a white neighbor, never prosecuted for the killing. His name is now among the thousands listed at the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. Josephine McCall went to the memorial. She is the daughter of Elmore Bowling. She's now 75 and described what that meant to her.
We have not been acknowledged, my family, as victims of a lynching. And this is the first opportunity that we'll have that someone will actually acknowledge the terrorism that we faced.
That video from the Associated Press. Kidada Williams, how past is this history? How present is it? We've obviously had in recent months arguments over the place of memorials and monuments to Confederate war generals, those who fought to sustain slavery, those presumably who had some sympathy with those who exacted retribution in the decades after the Civil War. How past is this?
It's not that past. Not at all. One of the things that we see from Mr. Bowling's family is that these families, they carried the sort of the cost of these killings with them even into the present day. They had their lives broken open and it wasn't recognized or acknowledged at the time, and they oftentimes didn't feel safe talking about it publicly. It's also present in the fact that what we have in modern day police and vigilante killings of unarmed African Americans is sort of like this legacy of lynching. And even the fact that we continue to debate what's happening, whether or not police and vigilantes who kill unarmed African Americans are going to be brought to justice, is part of the fact that it's still tied to these old mindsets that are sort of reinvented for the present day.
I'd like to take a call now from Appleton, Maine. Claire, what are your thoughts on this?
Hi, David. I am just thrilled that we're having this conversation and that monuments are going up to honor people that have been treated so badly in our country's history. And I think more of those Confederate statues need to come down and more of these need to go up in their place.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Claire. I want to offer a last vignette. Calvin McDowell, William Stewart, Thomas Moss, three men lynched March 9th, 1892 in Shelby County, Tennessee. They ran a grocery store. They were jailed because their store threatened the businesses of others who were white. A mob of 75 white men seized the three black men from jail, placed ropes around their necks, and murdered them in an open field. No one ever held responsible despite eyewitnesses and a grand jury investigation. You know, Brooke Kryft, you're the executive editor of the Montgomery Advertiser. It strikes me that what we're talking about is not only a failure, obviously, of justice and decency, but a failure of, in real time, people being – or even near time, people being willing to account for what occurred, people being willing to bear witness to that. Tell me what the response has been in your community to your acknowledgement of your newspaper's past as well as your state and your region's past.
Before I answer that, I want to bring something up about Elmer Bowling's family that I think is a super powerful piece.
Sure.
There's five children that still are alive because he was killed in 1947. Melissa Brown here at the Advertiser wrote a wonderful narrative about him, and it has one of the most gut-wrenching leads that I have ever read about one of his sons seeing his father shot on the side of the road. And he learned of a legend that he heard that you can't go to heaven with your boots on. So he went to his father's body, and he pulled his boots off so he could go from the side of the road and hopefully to heaven. And if you ever think about the affliction and the pain that occurs and what we're talking about today in the 21st century, it's firmly rooted in something that just happened in the mid-20th century.
I was going to say, bro, briefly, tell us what the reaction has been from your readers and your community to what you guys have unearthed about your own record, your own response in the face of these violence.
It's been overwhelmingly positive by telling those narratives, like the Bowling family, Robin White, and then also us self-reflecting and being self-aware of our part in the history. I'm extremely excited that the idea that people are saying, thank you for doing this. Thank you for putting out your sins laid bare for us and being honest. Because I think what's happening right now, there's too much finger-pointing, and people aren't necessarily looking at themselves and saying, admitting that they have made mistakes. And we profoundly made a mistake during that era, and it's important for people to see that, and hopefully they'll step forward and recognize their own connection to the past. We have received some calls, but very minimal calls of people saying that we need to move on, but we decided we can't move on. We have to reflect and then move forward.
That's Bro Kryft, executive editor of Montgomery Advertiser. Thanks so much, Bro, for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kedada Williams, she's professor of history at Wayne State University. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll leave you with Billie Holiday's classic rendition of the civil rights anthem, Strange Fruit, a haunting lyric protest of American racism and the lynching of African Americans. The lyrics are by Abel Meeropol. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree.